You're listening to the Empty Stringers podcast, where every week we talk about locating, catching, and the conservation of redfish. My hope is to share with you what I'm seeing from the polling platform so that together we can catch more fish. Think of it as your weekly fishing report. Welcome back to the podcast, folks. I'm your host, Matt Parrish. I got to get out on the water today for just a little bit with my buddy, Chris Colin. We launched around 10 a.m. I could not launch at my normal 6 a.m. Today because I had to take the kids to school and I had other stuff I had to take care of. And my purpose was I needed to get the boat. I've got some stuff I need to do to it. I need to clean it up. It's just got a little bit of maintenance needs to be done to it. And while I have it out, my plan is to clean it up and take it with me to the CCA Christmas party meeting thing that Drew Turner and I are going to speak at this next Tuesday, December the 5th. It starts at 7 o'clock. I have the address. I'm going to share all that info with you. But my plan, if there's parking, I got to Google map it and make sure that there is. But I have the skiff at home. I might as well bring it with me so everybody can take a peek at it just in case there's any future Sabine shoppers out there. You can take a look at it. So I guess I might as well drop that just right now. Let's see. Here are the details for that. Drew Turner of the Paddler's Playbook and me, Matt Parrish of the Empty Stringers podcast, we're going to speak about what? I'm not sure. We're going to speak at this get-together for the CCA. It is at 7100 High Life Drive, Houston, Texas, 77066. I will post that on my Instagram so everybody will know. It starts at 7 o'clock. I believe Drew is bringing his kayak, and he'll be able to talk about how it's all rigged out. I'm bringing my skiff, and it's going to be a good time. So you should come out, ask questions. We'll make up stuff and probably drink some what's that stuff? Cider? Whatever it is. This looks like it's at a beer place, so maybe we'll drink some beer. But yeah, Tuesday, December 5th, 7 p.m., 7100 High Life Drive, Houston, Texas, 77066. So anyway, got out on the water today. Could only fish from 10 a.m. till about 1:30 because I had to go pick my kids up, and I had to make a stop on the way home because my buddy Scott, his daughter, had a breaker that was tripping, and I went and swapped that out for him. But short time, so we decided to go stay as close as we could and still get on some fish. Now, this time of year starts to get tricky because we have a lot lower water levels than we did even a couple weeks ago. So the water went down in that last front we had. It hasn't completely come back. We've had some tides that were up a little bit, but by and large, we're not getting those 2 foot high tides that we have been getting. And here's the tricky thing about that. So 2 weeks ago, I was out in a marsh and the MLLW was 0.2. Now that 0.2 is about as low as I can possibly fish in that area. That was a 0.2 on a falling tide. Today, that 0.2 was lower. Not a ton lower, but it was a little bit lower than what it was that other day. And so if you've noticed that out there, here's what that's all about. The MLLW is the mean lower low water, right? If you are confused about what that is, there is an episode. I do a whole episode on it back in the archives. Scroll back there and take a peek. They're still, I think those are still on the Empty Stringer channel. I'm not sure about that. But here's what's up with it. I'll give you kind of a crash course. So mean lower low water. They took tide recordings, water level recordings, over a 19-year period. They call it the mean lower low water tidal datum epoch or something like that. That 19-year period, they took readings for every day, each day, and they recorded them. And so your MLLW, when it says above or below the MLLW, that MLLW is a moving target. So it makes it difficult to go, well, I guess the best way to explain it would be if you had a 2-foot high tide, 2 feet over MLLW, that is going to be higher if you have that tide in September than if you were to see that same reading on the gate in February. Why? Because the average water level for February is much lower than it is in September. I don't know what the swing is, but I can tell you that if you're not paying attention to it, this is the time of year where it can get you in trouble. So you kind of got to know. That's why you can't go strictly off of the chart data. You can't go strictly off of what the gauge says. You have to know your area. You have to get out there, and sometimes it means taking an educated guess, an educated chance, and going, all right, I think I was out there last week and it was 0.4 and I ran through there no problem. Today it's 0.2. I'm going to run through there again. And then you run through there. And then by the time you get down to maybe a zero, you go, or you had a close call, you ran too shallow, and you're like, I think that's the mark. And you look at the tide chart, you look at the month that it is, and you go, all right, I know that on an outgoing tide in December, I really can't run through these particular areas if it gets below a zero or below a 0.1 or a 0.2. That's kind of how you have to do it. Now, MSL or mean sea level, you'll also see on like the NOAA website, that is mean sea level. I guess the easiest way to explain that would be to say it is halfway between the high tide and the low tide. So it's at zero. It's whatever zero is for that day. Okay. It seems like this is the part I'm not sure of. I don't know if the MSL is a moving target or not, but from everything I've read, it does seem to be a moving target because you cannot have it halfway between the high and the low tide all the time. Because your zero, unless your zero is changing. If your zero is in the same place every time, you're going to have bigger swings on one end or the other. So what I'm trying to tell you is it's a guideline. You cannot look at the water levels and just throttle down and go for it. It's just different, and it's different enough because when you start getting to where, like today, on the way out, we ran through, what happened today is a great example. We ran through Pierce's Marsh to get to where we were going. Now, Pierce's Marsh is incredibly shallow this time of year. Tide was outgoing. It was 0.2 when we launched. We ran through and it was skinny. I mean, like, we were in stretches of up to 70, 80 yards. We were in 2-3 inches of water. where when you wake behind you, when you look at the wake behind you, you're staring at dry ground. You're staring at mud that you've washed up. But we made it, no problem. On the way back, we had an incoming tide, and it said 0.4. You would think 0.4, that's higher than 0.2. That's correct. It is higher. But what was happening in real life is you had an incoming tide now. And so if I'm using the Galveston Rail Bridge as my marker, the incoming tide is higher at the rail bridge than it is where I'm at, because I was Pierce's Marsh is, you know, what, 5 miles to the west of the bridge ish, right? So if I were to have just looked at that and gone, oh, I can make it no problem, I would have been high and dry, because you could see the different spoil banks and the reefs. The water was definitely lower because it had sucked out. The tide change had just happened and it had just starting to fill back up at the bridge. But that, you know, couple inches of water hadn't made it to where we were yet. It takes a little bit of time. So could have easily gotten stuck. And so we elected to go around that particular place on our way back. So you gotta get out there and know your area. If you're just learning your way around, you gotta get up there and pole it. You gotta slowly kind of feel your way out. There's no shortcut to this, other than just spend a solid 3 weeks exploring and poling and pushing around. But I mean, it just takes time. So, but I say that because now's the time of year where people are going to get stuck. You're going to start seeing the people that are fishing a lot usually know what they're doing, and they're not going to get stuck. But some of your diehard new guys out there are going to get stuck. I've been that guy before. I've been stuck. I've had to push out. I had to push out last week, I guess it was. I was coming around a corner. When I'm by myself in the boat and I'm full throttle, the weight is, it's light enough to where the weight and the torque of the motor are disproportionate. And if I make a corner in 4-5 inches of water, the boat might start to slide on me. And I know that. If I've got someone else in the boat with me to weigh it down a little bit, it doesn't do that all that bad. But I knew that I had the tendency to slide when I'm by myself. I was running through a very, very shallow area and took a corner where I know there is a shelf. And as soon as I started taking that corner, I started to slide. So I came off the gas. Well, when I went to hammer down again to try to straighten it out, I was already in an inch of water. I had nowhere to go but to churn mud. I ended up sliding it up onto an area that had water on it, you know, 4 hours ago, but it was a shallow little grass island area. I had to get out and shove it off and, you know, push to deeper water. So it happens. You don't know if you don't go, you know, you just got to get out there and do it. But you have to be smart about it and you have to be careful, because there are some boats that, like, if you get them stuck, you're not pushing them out by yourself. And so you got to know what you're working with and know that you're able to get yourself out. If I'm going to run up into a place full of shell, I'm not doing that, because I don't want to have to get out and push over shell or anything like that. Like, I'm, you know, pushing the limits in a muddy, shallow, muddy bottom. So word to the wise. I noticed there's some reefs popping up today that I haven't seen in a year. And they're going to eat some props. I can promise you that. Because people forget. Even I forget. I almost ran over one today because I gotten used to being able to run over it. I've got tracks laid down all over it on the GPS because the water's been plenty high. Not today. So we went around. Everything was cool. But we got back in the marsh and started finding redfish instantly. And so the cool thing about learning an area, and it's why I kind of drill home on like, pick an area and go learn every square inch of it. You're probably going to find that there's fish there. If it looked good to you on the map, if you thought, oh man, that looks like a good fishy area, there's probably fish there at most times of the year. And you just got to take the time to go learn that area and do it. So I know, because I spent a lot of time in the area we were in today, that there are sections of the marsh that have different depths. There's one particular section that normally on a good fall tide that is, you know, a foot and a half, 2 feet over MLLW, it's just too deep to fish. It's just, you can't see very well unless you're blind casting. It's just deep. Well, not today. It's nice and shallow today, but we had enough water to pull. So we got back in there and we found fish all over the place. But you gotta play the wind, the sun, all those things to your advantage if you want to get a good sight cast, because those fish were spooky today. Oh, I don't know why. I know a little bit about the science behind the barometric pressure. And I know that a change in atmospheric pressure apparently is not supposed to affect a fish that much at all. However, there's something causing the fish to be spooky on some days and not on other days. A week and a half ago, I was poling my boat up to redfish 3 feet away from them and catching them. I caught four redfish that were 3 to 6 feet away from my boat, okay? Dropped it in front of their face, caught them. Two on the fly, two on conventional. The fish today, if you whispered their name from 20 feet away, they were gone. I mean, Chris was up on the bow doing his best. He laid some great casts down, both on the fly and conventional tackle. Put good casts in front of fish that wouldn't eat. Now, then you start diving into, well, why wouldn't they eat? Was it because we had a purple fly on? Well, they were scarfing purple flies last week. So, I don't know. That's the mystery. So, what do you do when you're in that situation? Well, if you're stubborn like we were, you just keep throwing the same thing. If I had had a client on the boat, after that second or third fish had, because he got good looks and good casts on probably 4 to 6 fish that would not eat. After the second fish, I probably would have changed flies and gone with the more natural looking fly. I'm also big on the eyes. If the eyes are pronounced, I think this is just me. I think you have a better chance of getting a strike, triggering that instinct. I don't know why that is. It's just literally pure speculation on my part. But you got to change something. One of the things I see, again, I'm not trying to give anyone fly fishing advice because I'm still very new to it. But if I've had plenty of fly fishermen on the boat at this point, and here's what I have noticed with redfish. Longer strips, it's not good for a redfish. You want very short, pronounced strips of your fly. Inch it, inch it, inch it in front of him, and you get a better eat that way. If you're streaming it across like a foot or two at a time, doing big, long strips, I've just not, because that's what I was doing when I first started throwing, and I got a lot of refusals. So that's just my little tidbit. I don't know if I'm going to get somebody on here who actually knows what they're talking about. And I'll ask them that question for you. But with a paddle tail, I'm rolling it in front of their face. And then the second time I'm dropping it in front of their face, rolling it up to them and dropping it. And then the next time I'm dropping it well before I get to them, and I'm inching it across the bottom and twitching it at them. One of those three will usually get an eat. But you also have to you have to pay attention to that, but you also have to just not worry about it that much until you see the pattern, because I've seen fish totally refuse a paddle tail or a fly and then 10 minutes later, a different fish hammers that same bait. So it's really, each fish is different. It's how you present it. It's where he was, what he was thinking. Did he just eat 5 minutes ago? Maybe he's not eating anymore, you know? Did he eat a big breakfast? Who knows, right? It's just, you can't dive too much into that. You have to go, where's the next fish, you know? So today was fun. We saw a ton of fish. Didn't catch very many because they were so spooky, but we did okay. So what I did not see today was any shrimp. They're gone. And the truth teller today of that the pattern has, you know, officially changed into a winter pattern is Chris hooked a flounder right when we first started going. Flounder threw up a finger mullet, a little finger mullet, as he was being landed in the boat. And in fact, he had just eaten that finger mullet because it was still alive and it swam off. So that was cool. But they're eating mullet now, guys. You'll notice redfish are in areas where there are lots of finger mullet, and they're following big groups of mullet around. They'll kind of start following these horse mullet around, but they're not eating the horse mullet. They're eating the little finger mullet. I don't understand this symbiotic relationship. I just know it's true. You'll start to see the stingrays. You'll start to see the redfish and the mullet after that. So if you're in an area with a lot of mullet, there are plenty of times a year where I would say leave. This is not one of those times of year. Mullet are good for you this time of year. Stingrays, always good. If you're in an area you see stingrays, stick around and look for redfish. You'll find them. The redfish are less aggressive. They're not like charging down banks and blowing up bait left and right. They're kind of docile. They're looking for that one big meal. That's part of the reason why I think they're as picky as they are. When there's a lot of shrimp in the marsh, they're eating a lot of times a day. They're eating little shrimp. It takes more to get full. You're much likely to get one to strike. They're in feeding mode more of the time. Now the meals are bigger. You know, a couple of finger mullet in a day is a great meal. So for them anyway, I'm not eating it. So that's kind of what's happening in this winter pattern. When the water temperature drops below 48 degrees, or if we have a big temperature drop, if we have a 65, I talked about this last week, let's say water temperature's hovering in the 63 degree range and it drops down to, 45 degrees, 43 degrees, something crazy. Those fish are gone, man. They're going to come back when it starts to warm up, but they need time to adjust to that. What I think is going to happen more than likely is we're going to have varying water levels, but we're probably going to have water temperatures that range from 53 to 63 until we get that big winter blast of a cold front that I've been talking about. So that's great. If you can catch a sunny day with winds that are, 10, 12 or less, you've got great sight casting conditions. So you should get out there and don't let this shallow water, don't let the fact that the shrimp are gone keep you from the shallows. If you're used to fishing in a foot and a half, 2 foot of water, I would just urge you this time of year to go shallower than you think you should. Get up in a foot or less and do some exploring and see if you don't find redfish. They're there. Unless something big changes, that's where they're going to be. So that's the ticket for that. Here's a little safety tidbit. Did you know if you have a boat and you want to be legal as far as the Coast Guard is concerned, then you have to have, here's just a list of things you have to have, right? You have to have life jackets. They must be type 1, type 2, or type 3, Coast Guard approved. You got to have one for each person on board. You have to have a type 4 throwable life preserver. It's got to have a rope on it. You got to be able to throw it to someone. So that's something a lot of people miss. You have to have a fire extinguisher. You have to have a visual distress signal like a flare. And you need a sound-producing device, a foghorn, a whistle, something like that. So just running through that, that's something that people miss, people don't pay attention to. I went through that. My buddy Justin got his boat, and I had to look some of that stuff up to make sure I had it. And I ended up realizing I did not have the throwable device. So I've got to get one. Not super pumped about that because I don't know where I'm going to keep it, but I got to get one. So not that I'm getting stopped by game wardens out there. I haven't seen a game warden out in the marsh ever. Never have I ever seen a game warden in the marsh. So I don't know what they're out there doing. I'm sure they're protecting the wildlife in some kind of way. I would love to see game wardens out there in the marsh. I think that that's the only way they're ever going to be able to really enforce any kind of regulation. There's a lot of people that just feel like they're never going to get caught and they just keep on doing it. So if you happen to be a game warden and you want to tell me why none of you have ever been out in the marsh, or heck, I haven't even seen one in the bay. I'm not out in the open bay that often, but I travel enough down the intercoastal. I've never even seen a game warden out there, and I'm out there a lot. So I'm just saying, I think we could use a little more of a presence out there. I think it would go a long way. I know they're probably short-staffed. I know they're good people. I know they're working hard doing something. I just wish it was more on the rules and regulations of conservation side of things in the bay. So regardless of whether or not I see a game warden, I still need to be legal. So I'm going to get me a Type 4 throwable. And that is that. I'm going to get into the Bible tidbit. Here's what we got, folks. December 1st is this Friday. We're beginning the Advent season. So what does that mean? Advent, it is an attitude of worship with, I guess the best way to say it would be like an expectant heart for the return of Christ. You're celebrating his first coming, and you're longing for and expecting his second coming. And so what I like to do this time of year, we read the Christmas story, but I like to go through the Gospel of Luke. If you start on Friday, chapter 1, Gospel of Luke, you will read, if you read a chapter a day, you'll end up with Christ on the being, I think it's Christ being resurrected or going to the cross or something like that by the time Christmas gets here. And I know that that's not, Christmas is about him being born, but to celebrate his birth and to kind of create an anticipation for his return, it's good to read the Gospel of Luke. It takes you through his birth and his growing up into his own ministry that started at age 30 and ended around age 33. It takes you all through that ministry. And so I think it's a cool thing to do. So I'm going to be doing that. If you do it, let me know. I think you'll enjoy it. But because the Christmas season is upon us, I'm going to read a verse for you out of Isaiah. This is the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, written long before Christ was actually born. It's a prophecy about his birth. It's in chapter 9. It starts in verse 6. It says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." And he will. there you have it, folks. That's your Bible tidbit for the day. I hope that you guys get out and catch a ton of fish. I would love for you to come see Drew and I at the CCA North meeting at the address that I told you. I don't have it in front of me anymore. It's December 5th, Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. Show up. We're going to have a good time. Looking forward to seeing y'all there. If you want to reach me, you can email me at emptystringers@gmail.com. You can send me a message on Instagram at empty_stringers. I'm also on the TikToks at emptystringers. Yeah, I think that's it. Go listen to the Paddler's Playbook and the Salty Yak Outdoor Podcast. And go buy Kevin's custom painted lures. And I think that's it, folks. Y'all have a great week. I'll talk to you later.